Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Tyra Talks. Today, I will be discussing the first in-depth episode on vaccines, in particular regarding informed consent, as previously mentioned in my last episode. I will be looking at. I have to introduce everything slowly and thoroughly, just so that people are able to get a pen and paper ready and write down these organizations and what I'm saying and the sources that I'm discussing, so that you can go and do your own research. Of course, when it comes to informed consent, it's also very important that although I am happy to discuss this and provide information that I have found from my research, that it's exceptionally important that you do your own, so that you are responsible and empowered to guide yourself when it comes to your and your family's health, which of course is probably the most important thing in this life. A lot of people think it's other things until something happens, and then you just miss, immediately miss that part of you that was perfect before. So something as little as having a mouth ulcer or burning your finger slightly on the, when you're taking out something from the oven, you immediately realize just how sort of important and wonderful our bodies are. And health really is. So, the main organisations I'll be mentioning today are the following: the CDC, which is a Centre for Disease Control and Prevention, which is US based, but is a huge influence globally; the FDA, which is again US based, the Food and Drugs Administration; ASTA, US Department of Agriculture; Public Health England; European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, ECDC; National Health Federation, which is a non-profit organisation based in the UK for that advocates for the rights of people to have informed consent, and often very, very much heavily involved with healthcare professionals, healthcare regulation, and on top of all the legislation and recommendations that are being passed from our Department of Health, basically, which is extremely important. I didn't understand their role until I began my research. I'll also be looking at the General Medical Council, which is a regulator for doctors; the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, which is also known as the MHRA. The purpose they govern pharmaceuticals and drugs. The purpose of, regulatory bodies like the General Medical Council and the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency is first and foremost impartiality. I've worked in financial and healthcare regulation for the past 7 years, and the most important thing, apart from impartiality, is that the welfare of the public is its core duty. That's often why these organisations are set up. Quasi-governmental, in a way, is probably the best way to describe their model, and to also, I suppose, bring to light the fact that the reason why they were set up and the essence of their existence is to help the public and protect the public. However, the reason why I had to mention this is because the Medicine and Healthcare Regulatory Agency is one regulator that has been accused by our very own government, the House of Commons Select Committee on Health, of being corrupt. the Lancet Medical Journal and a BBC Panorama programme. For those who don't know what Panorama is, it's often investigative journalism that sort of looks into a lot of injustices that take place within the UK and abroad as well sometimes, but it is focused mainly on the UK, and it brings to light the issues that the public may not have been aware of but actually are directly impacted by, and in a sense it allows people to be armed with the knowledge that they need to make sure that they are not shortchanged or misinformed or treated badly, essentially. And BBC Panorama also supports this assertion of corruption against the MHRA. There's a website called mhrafraud.co.uk which provides links to all the reports that prove this. And there was a petition, and a petition that is still up today, which was signed by 10,000 people to disband the MHRA in 2015. And because of sort of the time, that's a lot of people, because I'm not sure about you, my listeners, but you probably haven't even heard of them, the MHRA. I mean, I certainly hadn't until I started working in the same industry of healthcare regulation. There is something else, although my main focus for this episode and the next one and possibly another one will be vaccinations, because it's obviously a very hot topic. People are incredibly disturbed by it. There's a lot of issues involved with regarding what actually is going on, and so I just wanted to make sure that I present the facts as they are, and if anyone wants to know my personal views on it, I'll be happy to discuss them one-on-one via my Instagram if necessary. But there is something else that I wanted to raise, because I did initially think that I was going to do a podcast on this, which I still might, and it's called the Cancer Act 1939. So yes, don't know if you've ever thought this before, but can you imagine that there's one sickness or disease that, you know, the big C word, that is common now? You can say it's quite a common disease. And in 1939, our government passed a law regarding this sickness. Now, I just want you to sort of just think about this, because when I first discovered that there was something called the Cancer Act back in 2009, I was quite shocked. I was thinking, why is that the only sickness with its own act? And for those who are legally minded, I mean, if you've even heard of it, because some people actually don't know about this, the existence of this act, and the fact that, you know, you don't get the Diabetes Act. So, you know, it's very interesting. So essentially, the Cancer Act, what it does is it makes it illegal to discuss the possibility of a cancer cure. It also means that no scientist, even if they have, can claim that they found the cure for a cancer. And I find that quite disturbing, because it's sort of, you know, we have the Cancer Research UK, which is regularly fundraising, regularly making, you know, millions a year. And we are supposedly one of the countries that provides the least funding in Europe for cancer research. But yet, we still have this act that disallows somebody from being able to, prohibits is probably a stronger word, the correct word, to even be able to come forth and discuss any findings. If anybody even asserts that they have a cure for cancer or have cured themselves of cancer by the usage of something natural, for example, they can be prosecuted and therefore must say, I don't believe that this cures it, or they can say the very bare minimum or maximum, if you like, is that this can help prevent cancer, that type of thing. You can never say something is a cure, which is very interesting, given that chemotherapy itself is actually based on herbal medicine, as is the majority of synthetic medication that's created initially came from the seed of it initially came from something natural, plant or a herb, or well, herb and plant is the same thing, but herb or bark or something that's been found in nature. And in order for it to be made widely available, it's needed to go through many processes of many processes that basically synthesize and create a different version that tries to emulate what that initial version tried to do. Sometimes it's created far weaker or for a reason, because we don't, our medical model in the West is not prevention based. It's supposed to be cure based, but again, you're not allowed to call, particularly for cancer, you're not allowed to call anything a cure. So we're in a bit of a double-edged sword when it comes to this particular sickness. Okay, so and now that I've introduced the sources, I will for the next part of the podcast go into the schedule, and I will also be going in. But before I do that, there is one other thing that I would like to add, which is that, as I mentioned to you earlier, that we have our European version of the Centre for Disease Control and Prevention centres, and on the 7th of December 2018, an EU Council recommendation was published, and it is based on the strengthened cooperation against vaccine preventable diseases. So, as you may be aware, it's been on the news a lot. There's been a lot of fear-mongering, there's been a lot of criticizing of activists and supposedly people online, also even health professionals and doctors with decades of experience have also been called, for lack of a better word, quacks, and they've been called out as being ill-informed, and all types of threatening behaviours used towards them. Their sort of published works have been censored off the internet, and various other attempts to block the other side being able to express what it is that they're trying to say without being completely bombarded with abuse on the side of the pro-vaccine debate versus the anti-vaccine debate. Whereas there was a fantastic article that I had read that said that actually most people are not on either extreme of the debate. And it's true with most things in life. Not many people are on the extreme side of either, you know, especially those who actually end up doing the research and doing the work to find out more about it. Because unfortunately, we live in a very fast-paced world, and it's difficult to balance life and family and work and social time. And not many people have the passion or even the concern enough to take hours out of their day to do research like this, because I can absolutely promise you it is utterly time consuming, and it does take a lot of dedication. And for someone like myself who, well, I get passionate about things and I want to find out, and therefore it becomes almost not an escape, but something that I don't mind doing. I sometimes enjoy learning about things like this, particularly something that can affect everyone's lives, you know? And so and because I need to learn things all the time, it's something that I find quite refreshing to dedicate myself to, although it takes a lot of time and effort. And therefore I appreciate that. And that's why I felt even more that it's important that some information is put out here that shows that balances the suggestions that are out there right now. So the first point of this of the recommendation of the council, it says, pursuant to Article 168 of the Treaty of Functioning of the European Union, a high level of human health protection is to be ensured in the definition and implementation of all union policies and activities. Union action, which is to complement national policies, is to be directed towards improving public health, preventing physical and mental illness and disease, and obviating sources of danger to physical and mental health. Now, the fourth point paragraph says, while vaccination programs are the responsibility of member states, the cross-border nature of vaccine-preventable diseases and the common challenges faced by national immunization programs would benefit from more coordinated EU action and approaches to preventing or limiting the spread of epidemics and diseases with a cross-border dimension. Now, this has come from the fact that there are a number of EU member states, Poland, Italy, Romania in particular, that have had issues with vaccine injuries, as well as the government or certain people as part of the government trying to force vaccines to become part of a program that every child, no matter what, must receive. Now, the reason why there's a lot of backlash is that there clearly has been, according to the vaccine injury reporting system, a reporting system that's available in the US, that is monitored by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. It's called the VIAS system, which has had hundreds of thousands of reported vaccine injuries, and what's classed as a vaccine injury. So when there are side effects straight after a vaccine, so a rash and vomiting and not eating and too much of heavy sleep and all of those things that are deemed normal are actually side effects that should be reported. And there are also a lot of parents take their children in, babies in particularly, to emergency care straight after because they drastically change and go through, all of these side effects, rashes, etc., which obviously is very troubling to a mother or a father to witness. And often people get very frightened and take them along to have them checked out, as you naturally would. That's just part of, your first reaction. So now, what I'd like to add though is that I don't know if you know much about activism and political activism or any type of activism, whether it's for feminine cause or whether it's to do with the transgender rights, whether it's to do with immigration or refugee rights, anything, or if it's to do with an anti-war situation, or if it's to do with assisting people who have been falsely imprisoned around the world, whether it's someone on death row who clearly doesn't deserve to be there, and therefore people campaign and create groups, campaign groups, and strong advocates and advocate for those people's rights via, and that's part of their activism, to say, look, we need to raise awareness because this is not right. This has happened and that's happened. And people create these groups because there is a reason to create those groups. It's not just something that they, funnel out of thin air and think, I'm just going to spend, my time being miserable and go through a very difficult, because often these campaigns are difficult because you have to learn about often very emotional issues and injustices. And I'm talking now about, I'm not talking about anything in this particular thing when it comes to vaccines. I'm talking about in general, when it comes to campaigns and activism, is often to do with quite something that's affects people significantly enough for somebody to lose sleep, for somebody to sacrifice family time, for somebody to take out time of their day to miss, a trip or miss an episode of their favorite show, to research, to read, to speak to someone, to, create documents to spread online, to update, to tweet or to update their blog or whatever it might be. So I just want you to keep that in mind, whilst I read the next part of this report, which is paragraph 5, which says, the rapid spread of misinformation through social media and by vocal anti-vaccination activists has fueled misconceptions that are shifting the public focus away from the individual and collective benefits of vaccination and the risks posed by communicable diseases and towards increased distrust and fears of unproven adverse effect events. Action is needed to strengthen dialogue with citizens, to understand their genuine concerns and doubts about vaccination, and to adequately address these issues on the basis of individual needs. And what I find quite interesting about this paragraph is the fact that it's saying that this campaign to bring more information to the public, this campaign to show that there are parents who have lost their children immediately after vaccinations, routine vaccinations, have come forward to essentially become activists to say that we're not the only ones, going through this. Yet we have the EU Council, along with the media, saying that these activists are spreading misinformation, completely trying to discredit the existence of a group of people or even individuals who are coming forward to say that something is dangerous or something has caused enough of a stir for people to come together and say, no, sorry. This is not okay. This is not what you say it is. And this is where I think we really need to stick our hats on and focus, because that's a very dangerous thing, isn't it? To say that, oh, your campaign means nothing. What you're saying is not true. Whereas almost every other campaign in history, other than campaigns for example, human rights issues in China, where the government hold blank, just point blank denies any human rights atrocities are taking place and completely just sort of pretends they don't exist. Aside from that level of disagreement with and sort of oblivion, it's like I've not heard of any other type of campaign be ridiculed the way that this particular one is being at the moment. So I will come back with the next one. We'll go through the schedule of vaccines, what they mean, ingredients lists, and the groups of people who often don't vaccinate and haven't done for decades, So yeah, stay tuned for the next bit and enjoy the music. Hi guys, welcome back to this episode on vaccines, and I wanted to go into the types of ingredients that are used in vaccines today. As mentioned previously, I'll be looking at the UK routine immunisation schedule, as I'm UK based and as are a lot of my family and friends. And of course, it's important because there are differences between our vaccines and the US based ones. Europe was the leading experts, if you like, on the development of vaccines. Of what we know as vaccines today, so we do have a huge sort of influence. We did have anyway on the development and distribution of vaccines. However, because of the types of laws that we have governing the types of ingredients we allow and are, when what we deem as safe in Europe does differ from, let's say, the Australia, New Zealand, and America, United States of America. So there are slight differences, even with the same manufacturer. However, there are not huge differences, and there are books that discuss this, these recommendations. So, like Dr. Miller's Critical Vaccine Studies, which is, in my opinion, probably unbiased, factual, just sort of focuses directly on the scientific study. It's peer reviewed, and then it gives you the analysis, and it's done in a very easy to read way. And this book was put together for those who wanted to know more about vaccines and parents as well. And what's sort of quite nice about it is the fact that it says things like a vac this vaccine would be safe if this ingredient was removed, for instance. So that way, when somebody reads that, other sources they would have learnt from or read will be a huge assistance to them in making the decision as to whether that's something that that is right for their family or not, which is very, very important. Unlike, the unfortunate array of articles that pop up the moment you type in something to do with vaccines on Google, unfortunately, it is ridiculous that you get very one-sided, journalist-based information about. Written by people who are completely so far removed from anything to do with medical negligence or pharmaceuticals or the purpose behind something, how it was developed, the money behind it, the sort of economical return on something like a vaccine program, and what sort of is beneficial. And it's so interesting because we don't know why this journalist, for instance, has decided to write a very one-sided article. I mean, who approached them to say, do you fancy writing an article about this or from this perspective? And it's very dangerous, isn't it? Because yes, they've gotten out their article, but then you have got a bunch of scared parents putting in these questions in Google, and it returns with the very basic information that is often one-sided, often regurgitated information from somebody who is very pro, if you like, because I'm trying to stay away from the idea of pro and anti because it's far more it's sort of unintelligent to assume that there's just two ends of the spectrum when it comes to vaccines, and there's nobody in between, which is completely false. There are a whole, the vast majority of people are in between, cautious, curious, wanting to know more. I'm going to be very sort of frightened by the types of information that's out there, and rightly so. It is something to be afraid of, because it does have side effects. These articles are assuming that there are no side effects to vaccines, that they are 100% safe and effective. There's absolutely nothing that's 100% safe and effective, right? As we all know, because everything has its risks, and every type of medicine or any type of biological intervention for your body will have its risks with it. So, and that's absolutely something just sort of commonsensical, really, to ensure that you, don't just take your hat off when you for, by reading, one article or even 5 to 7 articles from the BBC and standard news outlets who seem to be currently covering just the one side, which is quite sort of problematic, really. Dr. Wakefield is probably one of the most renowned doctors, for a British doctor, who made an assertion from his studies that he was conducting on vaccines, particularly the MMR vaccine, which came back with the huge controversy about its links to autism. And it's so sort of mind-blowing, just the way sort of Chinese whispers, society is, the way that we operate in our information and speech in Chinese whispers, and then you end up with this completely different story. And what's happened is earlier this year, Dr. Wakefield was exonerated from the accusation that what he said about the MMR vaccine was completely false. In fact, Dr. Thompson came out and completely agreed with him and said that actually what he said was correct, that they had noticed that there was a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Dr. Miller, who discusses in his book, Critical Vaccine Studies, 400 Critical Vaccine Studies, also had found in his studies that there was a link between vaccines containing heavy metals like aluminium and mercury, thimerosal, that they found that children did develop autism from those, or if you like, children who had those did end up with autism. So it's very interesting, and there's been quite a lot of European doctors as well who have found that the information that Dr. Wakefield initially presented is accurate. So, but it's not just as a result of it's not an automatic result. There's like a chain reaction that leads to that, often to do with gut health and the damage that some vaccines can be seen to be doing to the gut is what sort of they look into. And it's of course a very deep topic. It's not something that you can just have a little chat about and here we go. You've got everything you need. It's not, it takes months of study at least. And I'm not talking about Googling a few articles. I'm talking buying books, watching a whole list, host of documentaries, looking through package inserts, which can be found on the manufacturer's websites or the FDA website, the CDC website. Really good sources to find what it says. Although it lists the side effects, and then it'll say, for example, I'll give you an example. So, One insert, so the MMI insert, which I had just read again, suggests that because the one of the vaccines is created within with the use of eggs, chicken eggs, and chick embryos. As a result of them growing that vaccine within the egg, children who are allergic to eggs are likely to have an allergic reaction to the vaccine. Okay. Now, the one thing that you might want to look into, I'm not going to go into it, probably not, but you look into it, because this is all about presenting you with facts of both sides, but essentially the side that's severely underrepresented currently, and just for you to go and research and find points in which to research and grow your questioning and understanding of where all of this information and controversy is actually coming from, and leaving out the buzzwords like controversy, for instance. So it says, going back to that insert, so it says, for example, that, you know, a child may get hives or a rash or possibly even an anaphylaxis, but if you do want to still continue to give the child that vaccine, even though they are allergic to the ingredients in it, then the doctor should have a antihistamine ready, basically, to assist should the child go into some kind of anaphylaxis. The issue with that, of course, is that if somebody goes into anaphylactic shock, it can lead to death, even if they're in hospital. Plenty of people die from anaphylaxis every day in a hospital. So I find it rather strange that in a bid to push for something's safety, even though they contradict themselves within the very statement, they still suggest that you can give the vaccine, almost to tell the parent that they should. It's really misleading and really sort of difficult for, I think, a parent to be able to differentiate what that's trying to say, because when you go to a doctor or somebody who you deem a professional, you expect them to have that knowledge to be able to assist you with the correct factual information. So, you know, that's why, you know, what we are coming to now, that the sort of age we're in, is that we, especially people, if you're intellectual enough, you are educated to a level that you can understand, you know, when you read something, or if you don't understand it, you can dig further or ask questions or know somebody who can break it down for you, somebody who can bounce the ideas off of, then you're in a fantastic position, a privileged position, where you can get the information that you need. And we're in a position now that the studies that you and I read, that's the same ones that doctors read. Not every single doctor, particularly not a GP, they don't go into labs like every other week to go and test out your vaccines. In fact, it has been absolutely noted fact that on the medical degree, they have nothing more than a maximum four-hour lecture on the administration of vaccines, and that's it. They don't go into detail. They don't go into information about the ingredients or side effects. And this has been countless times been agreed by medical students and doctors. A lot of people. So, for example, there's an organization now called Nurses Against Vaccines, and nurses are the ones who generally tend to administer them, to be honest. But Nurses Against Vaccines are a group who have come forward and said, we have learnt about this and we have witnessed XYZ of side effects. We have witnessed children fainting and having seizures and going into anaphylactic shock and crying uncontrollably and that type of thing. So they've come forward with that information to say that they're no longer in support of administering this, and it's not something that they were taught in school when they were going through nursing school. So it's very interesting. Now, I wanted to start with the vitamin K shot, which is what you think when you hear the vitamin K shot, which is the very first one that we are offered as babies or offered to our babies, is was created in the 60s. And as in, to be honest, most vaccines and injections, routine ones we get, were created sort of not that long ago. I mean, our grandparents probably didn't have any vaccines, maybe one or two. So the vitamin K shot contains alcohol as a preservative. It contains polysorbate 80. You can Google that and find out what you think it what it is. And quite a high dose of vitamin K, but of course it's got a few other preservatives in there. Now, the reason for the vitamin K shot is because one in 15,000, they said 10, but now it's looking more like 15. Around 1 in 15,000 babies are born with a vitamin K deficiency to the extent that their blood cannot clot, and if they have a traumatic birth, it can cause bleeding on the brain, so they have hemorrhages, and because they hemorrhage, that's why they decided that the vitamin K shot is to be given to every single baby, so it's in case, just in case. But they know now that it's rare, so you don't necessarily have to give it to every baby. So when people question it, what they tell you now is they say that if you are on your way home from the hospital and you were to get into a car accident, then that shot could potentially save your baby's life. And that's how they sort of sell it to you. They say that breastfed babies are likely to get the lowest dose of vitamin K, and formula fed babies are more likely to get enough because the milk and the formula is already fortified with vitamin K. Well, there's vitamin K and K1 and K2, which we should also look into. And the K1 that's given to babies is 20,000 times the amount that's required by the body at that point, which is toxic. It's not toxic enough to, well, I don't know. I can't speak on that. I would have thought it's not toxic enough to kill you. But there are a rather large number of babies that do die within the first couple of days of birth, who happen to receive the vitamin K shot. The United States has got the highest level of infantile death within the first 4 days of being born, in the industrialized world. So they have, basically, in the developed world, they have the highest rate of death in all babies, and that's one of the only countries that gives both vitamin K and the hepatitis B vaccine together on the same day one of baby's birth. And of course, the reason why baby can't develop his or her own supply of vitamin K straight away is because it only starts developing on day 8 after the gut bacteria has grown, and is able to help create the vitamin K. And And also, that's also to do with the development of the liver and how the liver actually is able to process toxins. So, a baby is not able to process toxins in their body in that first instance because their liver's not really working yet. So, to give them a vaccine that the body needs to immediately detoxify from, which is what our body does as part of the immune response that's triggered. Unfortunately, a baby can't really, not all babies can cope with it. So that might be one of the reasons why they're saying that the United States has such a high level of death within the first 4 days. So we move on now. Say that the CDC has said on its website, it says that there are risks and side effects from vaccines. I like the fact that they have admitted that because, according to the Google searches, all the articles suggest that there are no risks or side effects to any vaccines whatsoever. Okay, so I'm going to go into now. It says the DTaP vaccine, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, the whooping cough. Whooping cough is what we call it here in the UK, but it's pertussis. That's the other name for it. I wanted to quickly also give the list of the recommended routine immunizations in the UK. So, at 8 weeks old, we get the DTaP, which I just mentioned, and the pneumococcal, and it has 13 types of strains of virus in there. The meningococcal and the rotavirus, all at 8 weeks old. Okay. And at 12 weeks old, there's a diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, polio, Hib, and hepatitis B, which are, that's the one, two, six in one, and the rotavirus by mouth. That's a live virus, and it's just given under the tongue. At 16 weeks old, they're given the DTaP again, pneumococcal again, and this time meningitis B at 16 weeks old. At 1 years old, they give the Hib, the meningitis C, pneumococcal, MMR, meningitis B booster. And then after that, they're allowed to have the flu vaccine. And then at 3 years, they do the MMR and the DTaP again. And that's, so up until the age of three, that's what you get. So DTaP and PCV, and there's like the five in one and the six in one. So you have to count each individual one and the doses they give for each individual one, and then you'll see how many vaccines a child is actually receiving, which is the easiest way to actually break down the figures and how much of each ingredient you're likely to end up getting within that first 12 months of the child's life. So, what are the risks from the DTaP vaccine? According to the CDC website, it says redness, soreness, swelling, tenderness, fever, fussiness, tiredness, poor appetite, vomiting, more serious reactions such as seizures, non-stop crying for 3 hours or more, high fever, swelling of the entire arm, long-term seizures, coma, lowered consciousness, permanent brain damage, even though it's rare, but there's a remote chance of a vaccine causing a severe allergic reaction, other serious injury, or death. Okay. Okay, so that's the DTaP. Let's go into the hepatitis B vaccine side effects. Soreness again, temperature. So again, it says that any medication can cause a severe allergic reaction. Such reactions from a vaccine are very rare, estimated at about 1 in 1 million doses. But it has also got a chance of serious injury or death. Okay. It's interesting that they are getting facts and figures saying one in about a million doses, because the way that they monitor the way that they monitor this death and injury is based on VIAS, a system of reporting that is based on the US. This is the US government now, that requires you to report any injury. So inconsolable crying from 3 hours or more is something that needs to be reported. But a lot of people don't know about that. Neither do nurses, neither do doctors. So often the actual paperwork is just, something that they'd rather avoid. So it's just an administration issue, to be honest. And when I say administration, I don't mean actually giving the vaccine, but I mean the paperwork side of things. And so, people do end up just not reporting it. Okay, a lot of deaths that occur. So on the CDC website, they have got lists of deaths and what happened and what they found, and the VIAS reporting system rather does go into that and says that of the children who died, it talks about the fact that over 79% of them had gotten a vaccine. What it does also say is that it doesn't mean that the vaccine has caused the death, but it doesn't also exclude the fact that the vaccine may have caused the death, if you understand what I mean by that. So the VIAS system is something that is really, really important that you look into yourself, I believe, because and it's called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Okay. So there is a I think it's fair to say that, when the National Vaccine Information Centre said that, look, know the risks, okay, the wide spectrum of vaccine complications do include brain inflammation, encephalopathy, chronic nervous system dysfunction, anaphylaxis, febrile seizures, Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS, brachial neuritis, acute and chronic arthritis, thrombocytopenia, smallpox, polio, measles, varicella, zoster vaccine strain infection, death, mainly from, and this is what this website says, smallpox, polio, and measles vaccine. We don't have the smallpox vaccine here in the UK, so that's not something we need to be concerned with. The death, yeah, so it says death, polio, and measles vaccine. Shock and unusual shock-like state, protracted inconsolable crying, syncope, deltoid bursitis are the main spectrum, but that's a spectrum of vaccine complications. Okay, so and brain inflammation is something that they do see quite often, and sometimes there are other health professionals now speaking about this and talking about the links between that and what we call baby shaking syndrome. And the numerous parents have said we didn't shake the baby. But they've said that's what's happened, and because of the damage to the brain, and most of those babies were vaccinated, so it's quite an interesting observation. The other point that I wanted to raise is currently, the news is going a little bit wild. We are now in March 2019, and the news has got constant, measles outbreak here, and the Rockland County issue in America is essentially saying, well, if you're not vaccinated, you're not welcome anywhere. You can't be part of society. You can't come into our libraries, our schools, our shopping centres. You can't live here, basically, is what it's saying. And really sort of creating huge fear in people. And I think it's really important to know that over 70%, maybe 80%, I've literally forgotten the figure, it's either 76 or 86% of the people who have encountered measles are vaccinated. So the people who have got the out, who are part of the outbreak, who are experiencing the measles, are vaccinated individuals. Like, let that sink in. There are a lot of, the MMR vaccine insert does actually say that one of the side effects is measles or mumps. So it'll tell you that if you have a boy, then you need to check that they might have swollen testicles, swollen glands, So if somebody is immunocompromised, so a newborn baby or people with HIV or people going through chemotherapy, or just any other type of disease that affects your immune system, then you shouldn't go around a child who's been vaccinated in the last 4 weeks with the MMR vaccine, which I find very, very, very interesting because that's the advice given by the CDC, right? So do look into that. Just for your own myth busting, information and knowledge. So yeah, so that's that. I did want to go into another element of safety and the constant push about the safety of vaccines. And if they are so safe and they're so effective and there's absolutely no way that it can cause injury or death, which is what a lot of people seem to be claiming, why is it that we have in the UK why is it that in the UK we have a vaccine injury fund, government-based vaccine injury fund that pays out £120,000 if you can prove that from the list of vaccines from DTaP, polio to MMR, if you can prove that they have been brain damaged, paralyzed, or died as a result of those vaccines? Most people don't even know about the Vaccine Injury Fund in the UK. The vaccine damage payment is what it's called. It's a one-off tax-free payment. If you are severely disabled as a result of a vaccination against certain diseases, it goes into what you'll get, your eligibility, how you apply for it, the age you have to be when you were injured, usually under 18. The UK government has paid out around £73 million to nearly 1,000 children and adults, representing one in eight claimants who were minimum 60% injured by a vaccine between 1979 and 2014. Vaccines have been accepted by most governments to cause a multitude of devastating injuries, including brain damage and death, of course. And as a result of which they have created this, there's a compensation fund that's also been created in the US that has paid out $4 billion, $4 billion to date of children to parents of children who have been injured or died as a result of vaccines. And to be honest with you, just those figures alone are literally making me shake right now. Because they're huge, and you have to remember that most people don't even know about this. So, and hardly, less than 2% of vaccine injuries are even reported, and yet $4 billion have been paid out already. Here in the UK, 73 million has been paid out already, and nobody that I know, not a single member of my family, and I have a massive family, not a single one of my friends. Nobody knew about the Vaccine Injury Fund. Nobody. I didn't even know about it. I just stumbled across it when I typed it in because I wanted to know more about vaccine injury lawyers here in the UK, particularly the barrister who I'm still looking for, who represented the successful prosecution against the death of against the death of a child who died as a result of the MMR vaccine, and so I beg your pardon. Actually, I think that was the one that was autism. So where they found the autism link and the parents got paid out and won the case as a result of it, and a barrister did represent that, and it wasn't that long ago. I believe it was 2013. So I am still looking for that particular barrister, because they made very strong arguments for the causation and the link between the two, and it's really, really important, because you know, when you are a barrister and you are learning about medical negligence, and you are learning about how to question and analyze something that is as a result of a type of medical treatment or operation, or you know, whatever it might be, and you learn to question things, you're taught to really sort of break things down, learn the terminology, ask the right questions, figure out who is the expert in that particular area. So for vaccine injury, you wouldn't go to a GP. Okay, what you'd do is you'd go to the source, which is an immunologist or an epidemiologist. I always struggle with that word. So you'd go, or a biomedical scientist. Epidemiologist. That's it. That's the one. So, it's really, really important. There's another website actually called vaccineinjury.uk, and jabs.org.uk. In the UK, we've also got a baby jabs clinic. I have recommended my friends to go there, where you can speak to, it's a private clinic, but you can speak to the founder, who also mentions that he's neither for nor against, and he just says he offers a safe way to provide babies with the vaccines. So instead of giving a baby a 6-in-1, where he has to deal with 6 types of illnesses all together and his little body's fighting it, as a result of which they found that particular vaccine can cause death, as stated by the CDC and the manufacturer. They say it's very, very, very rare. However, on the basis that it can do, doesn't matter how rare it is, in my personal sort of opinion, I think it's important that you do speak to a professional. So when you speak to someone at Baby Jabs Clinic in London, he'll be able to explain that information to you. And he can do antibody tests to see what the mother, what antibodies the mother has passed on to the baby, and therefore which ones the baby would benefit from getting, instead of every single baby getting every single dosage at exactly the same amount, right? Because you know, we all need different amounts of different medication. That's why we're told not to share medication, right? So I might need, you know, 120 micrograms of iron, and my friend might need 13, you know, so it wouldn't really make a difference. I'd end up giving them an overdose of iron for their system, and I'd be underdosed if I was to take theirs. So it's really sort of interesting how the dosage works, when for every other medication, the dosage is, you know, individualized, which is also another thing that's worth considering in this particular argument. But with the Baby Jabs Clinic, I think what's very interesting is he's able to then tell you, you know, what if you want to do the MMR, for instance, then you might want to do single shots, which were proven to be much safer, in which case you might want to give, you know, the measles at one point, go back a few months later, and then do the mumps, etc. And he'd be able to explain whether or not there are any jabs created without a particular ingredient in, right? So that that if a child is allergic to that particular ingredient, then it might be that another manufacturer creates one without it, and then it'll be a lot safer for that child to have that particular vaccine instead, right? So finally, for today's for this particular episode, I just wanted to go into the other common ingredients and fillers that are in vaccines. So the ingredients do include aluminium hydroxide, aluminium phosphate, ammonium sulfate, amphotericin B, animal tissues, pig blood, horse blood, rabbit brain, dog's kidney, monkey kidney, chick embryo, chicken egg, duck egg. I have to say that when I read those, I was a little bit surprised. Dog kidney, really? But apparently so. Calf bovine serum. That's from beef. That's from a cow. Beta propylactone. Fetal bovine serum, formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is often the ingredient that's quoted as the only known carcinogenic ingredient in vaccines. Do look it up. It is a listed neurotoxin that is supposed to cause cancer, but I'm not sure why a lot of the pro-vaccine lobby tend to generally say that it makes no difference, though. If it's injected, it's completely different. And usually, if you please also research the difference between injection and ingestion. So me consuming a little bit of fish, say, that has mercury in it, will probably push its way through my system. I'll be able to detox it out, etc. But when something is injected into my muscles and my tissue and it's gone to my brain because it crosses the blood-brain barrier, then that's much harder to get rid of. Just sort of basic science. So look into that before you decide whether formaldehyde is something you want to be concerned about when it comes to vaccine ingredients. Formalin, gelatin, glycerol, human diploid cells originated from human aborted fetal tissue. Hydrolyzed gelatin, monosodium glutamate, neomycin sulfate, phenol red indicator, phenoxyethanol, antifreeze, potassium diphosphate, potassium monophosphate, polymyxin B, polysorbate 20, polysorbate 80. Please Google those as well. Porcine pancreatic hydrolysate of casein. That's from pig. Residual MRC5 proteins, sorbitol, sucrose, thimerosal, mercury, tributyl phosphate, which is a continuous line of monkey kidney cells, washed sheep red blood cells, and that information is compiled from What About Immunizations and the Health Studio newsletter. Volume 1, Vaccine Fillers and Ingredients. So please have a little research on everything that's been mentioned in today's episode. And I hope it's been informative. I will come back and make the second one. I'll probably go into further information on particular things that seem to come up a lot. And thank you to those of you who have responded and asked me to go into further points and asked further information. Whatever responses I get from this particular episode, I will also be coming back with further information on. And in the meantime, I'm going to continue my studies, and I will next time definitely be mentioning another whole list of books and documentaries that you should definitely watch for your own research purposes. And I hope that this is encouraging you to read and research both sides accurately, because currently Google is only allowing you to find one side, unfortunately. Okay, so love and light. Please keep up the research, reading and questioning, and don't forget to question everything all the time. Until next time, thank you for listening and enjoy the music.